You ever lose something so completely that you just accept it is gone? I mean truly gone, not misplaced, not forgotten in a drawer, but swallowed whole by the earth itself. I am Tail Dragger on the Hangar Radio Hangar, and tonight I want to tell you about a fighter plane that disappeared beneath a glacier for half a century, and the stubborn group of people who decided that was not good enough reason to leave it there. Pull up a chair for this one. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you have earned it, they have got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let us go back to July of 1942. The war is young for America, and everything is urgent. The Army Air Forces need aircraft in England, and they need them now. The problem is you cannot just fly a P-38 from the States to Britain without stops. The range is not there, so they set up a ferry route through Labrador, then Greenland, then Iceland, then Scotland. They called the Greenland leg the most dangerous stretch of the whole journey, and they were not exaggerating. On July 15, 1942, a flight of 6 P-38 Lightnings and 2 B-17 Flying Fortresses departed from a base in Greenland heading east. The formation was codenamed Operation Bolero. These were brand new airplanes, not a scratch on them. The P-38s were F models, fresh off the Lockheed assembly line in Burbank, California. Then the weather closed in. And when weather closes in over the Greenland ice cap, it does not play around. We are talking whiteout conditions, zero visibility, ceilings on the deck. The entire formation got boxed in by a wall of clouds and ice fog that erased the horizon completely. They tried to push through, could not. Tried to go around, could not do that either. The flight leader made the call to turn back, but the base behind them had socked in too. They were stuck, no runway in front, no runway behind, nothing below but ice. Now here's where it gets interesting. Every one of those pilots, all 8 of them, put their airplanes down on the ice cap. Belly landings gear up onto a glacier surface at about 9,000 feet elevation, and every single crew member walked away. 8 aircraft, 25 men, not a single fatality. That alone is a story worth telling. The crews were rescued over the next several days by dog sled teams and a Coast Guard vessel. The airplanes were left behind, and why not? There was a war on. Nobody was going back for 6 fighters and 2 bombers sitting on top of a glacier in the middle of nowhere. The ice had other plans. Greenland's ice cap is alive. It moves, it breathes, and most importantly, it accumulates. Year after year, storm after storm, fresh snow piled on top of those airplanes, compressed into ice, layer after layer after layer. Within a few years, you could walk right over the spot and never know 8 warbirds were sleeping beneath your boots. For decades, they stayed there. Buried. Forgotten by most, but not by everyone. In 1981, a businessman and aviation enthusiast from Middlesbrough, Kentucky named Pat Epps teamed up with a fellow named Richard Taylor. These two had the kind of optimism that makes sensible people nervous. They were going to find those airplanes and bring them home. Simple as that, except nothing about it was simple. First, they had to find them. The original coordinates from 1942 were approximate at best, and 50 years of ice movement meant the planes had drifted from where they went down. Think about that. The whole glacier had been sliding, slowly but relentlessly, carrying those aircraft along with it. Their first expedition used metal detectors. Nothing. The ice was too deep. Then they tried magnetometers, got some readings, but nothing conclusive. It took multiple trips to Greenland, years of effort, and finally a ground-penetrating radar system to locate the aircraft, and when they did, they could not believe the numbers. The planes were not 10 feet down, not 30 feet down, not even 100 feet down. Those P-38s and B-17s were buried under more than 260 feet of solid ice, 268 feet to be precise. That is nearly the length of a football field, straight down, through compacted glacial ice. Most people would have called it quits right there. Pat Epps and Richard Taylor called in more equipment. They developed a thermal device called a super gopher. Basically a long copper tube that circulated hot water to melt a shaft straight down through the ice. They melted their way down, foot by foot, creating a vertical tunnel barely wide enough for a person to descend. When they finally reached aircraft depth, they opened up a horizontal cavern around one of the P-38s. They called this particular airplane number 417-630, but she would soon earn a much better name. Down in that cavern, 268 feet below the surface, the temperature hovered around negative 20 degrees Celsius. The workers wore full cold weather gear. The lighting was industrial, the air had to be pumped down from above. It was like working in a mine, except the walls were ice and the prize was a Lockheed Lightning. The airplane was in pieces, the ice had not been gentle. Decades of pressure had crushed the fuselage, collapsed the twin booms, and deformed the wings. This was not going to be a simple pull-it-out-and-fly-it situation. They had to disassemble what was left of the airframe, cut sections into manageable chunks, and haul each piece to the surface through that narrow shaft. It took the recovery team the better part of 1992 to extract all the major components. They used a custom-built cable system to winch pieces up through the tunnel. Some components had to be cut further just to fit. The two Allison V-1710 engines were among the heaviest pulls. Each one weighed over 1,000 pounds, and they had to come up through a hole barely 4 feet in diameter. When everything finally reached the surface, they loaded it onto sleds and hauled it to the coast where a ship was waiting. From Greenland, the wreckage went to Middlesboro, Kentucky, where a restoration shop had been set up in a building that used to be a car dealership, and that is where the real work began. Now I have seen some restorations in my time. I have watched guys spend 5 years on a Stearman, 10 years on a Mustang, but what they attempted with this P-38 was something else entirely. They were not restoring an airplane, they were resurrecting one. The original airframe was so badly damaged that it served more as a template than a starting point. They had to fabricate new skins, new structural members, new control surfaces. The twin booms were rebuilt from scratch using original Lockheed drawings. The center nacelle, where the pilot sits, was painstakingly reformed. Every rib, every stringer, every bracket. But here's what separates this project from a pure replica. They used every original component they could save. The main spar carried over. Several forgings and castings from the original were cleaned up and reused. The landing gear assemblies were overhauled. They found the original data plates and installed them in the rebuilt airframe. This airplane was going to carry its own identity. It was still number 417630. The Allison engines were sent out to specialists who tore them down to the last bearing. Amazingly, the cold had preserved much of the internal metallurgy. Corrosion was minimal compared to what you would find in a wreck sitting in a tropical jungle or a saltwater environment. The deep freeze had actually helped. They rebuilt those Allisons to flight-worthy condition, which in the world of warbird engines means a small fortune and a lot of patience. The project went through financial ups and downs. Supporters came and went. There were times when the whole effort looked like it might stall permanently, but the team in Kentucky kept working. Roy Schaffner, a local businessman, became a major backer and eventually the airplane's owner. He poured resources into the project when others would have cut their losses. They named her Glacier Girl. On October 26, 2002, Glacier Girl took to the sky for the first time in 60 years. Steve Hinton, one of the finest warbird pilots alive, was at the controls. The takeoff was from the Middlesboro Bell County Airport in Kentucky, a modest strip surrounded by mountains. The crowd was enormous, people who had followed the project for years, people who had worked on the recovery, people who just wanted to see a miracle. And it was a miracle. Those twin Allisons came alive with that unmistakable rumble. If you have ever heard a P-38 at full power, you know the sound. It is not the snarl of a Merlin. It is a deeper, smoother roar, two 12-cylinder engines running in harmony. The counter-rotating propellers eliminated the torque that bedeviled single-engine fighters. She climbed out clean, tucked the gear and flew, 60 years under the ice. 268 feet of glacier, a decade of recovery and restoration, and there she was, banking against a blue Kentucky sky like she had never been away. Glacier Girl went on to become one of the most recognizable warbirds on the airshow circuit. She appeared at Oshkosh, at Sun and Fun, at events across the country. Every time she flew, she carried a story that no other airplane in the world could match. Now I want you to think about what this project really meant beyond the spectacle. Those 8 aircraft that went down in 1942 were a snapshot of a specific moment in history. They were production fresh, P-38F models on their way to war. They never saw combat. They never had field modifications or squadron markings or battle damage repairs. Glacier Girl is the closest thing we have to a factory new Lightning, a time capsule from 1942. The recovery also taught us something unexpected about glaciology. The rate at which those planes had been buried, more than 5 feet per year on average, gave scientists hard data about ice accumulation rates in that part of Greenland. It became a reference point for climate researchers studying the ice cap. An airplane recovery project accidentally contributed to science. There is a piece of this story that always gets me, though. Down in that ice cavern, when the recovery crew first laid eyes on the airplane, they found personal effects. A letter never mailed, some personal items belonging to the pilot, remnants of a life interrupted by weather and war, preserved in ice like a message in a bottle. Those items made it back to the families, flying lives on in what we choose to save, and sometimes what we save chooses to come back from places nobody thought possible. The research for tonight's story comes from the Glacier Girl recovery team's own accounts, the Lost Squadron Project archives, and several excellent pieces published by Air and Space Magazine and the Smithsonian. Stop by radiohanger.com if you want to dig deeper. I'm Taildragger. Go find something worth saving. See you next time.